The year is 937, and England, under Æthelstan, has been a united nation for just over a decade, prior to this it being a collection of warring kingdoms, united by a common language but divided politically. At Brunanburh in the year 937, somewhere in the north of England, in an as yet unknown place, a battle was fought, with Æthelstan and the English on one side, and a triple alliance of kingdoms on the other. Scotland, led by Constantine II, the Brittonic Kingdom of Strathclyde, led by King Owen, and the Norse Kingdom of Dublin, led by Olaf Guthrithson. Such was the legacy of the battle that in this time of the historian Æthelwerd writing in the late 900s, Brunanburh was still known as the Great Battle by the common people. It was a battle that would decide the future of the British Isles. So much so that, according to historian Michael Livingstone, the location was chosen in agreement with the commanders on the assumption that there would be one fight and to the victor went England. Ever since Rome had pulled out of Britain in the early 400s in the wake of barbarian conquests in more vital areas of the empire, invasion from overseas had become the norm. Just as the mainland Romans had suffered incursion after incursion by warlike cultures from across the Rhine, such as the Goths, the Franks, the Vandals, and the Huns, Britain too was seen as easy pickings for the warlike cultures of modern-day northern Germany and Denmark. The Anglo-Saxons, as they came to be known, represented many different cultures, such as the Jutes, Angles, Saxons, and Frisians, who seem to have journeyed across the North Sea, first as raiders and later as settlers in the mid-5th century AD. Why they initially came to England is still heavily disputed by historians, largely due to a significant lack of reliable sources from this time period, this being one of the reasons why the period is traditionally known as the Dark Ages. Speculation is rife as to whether the Anglo-Saxons were invited by the Romans as auxiliary mercenaries, employed to help protect the province from similar nomadic peoples like themselves, or whether, sensing weakness, they took it upon themselves to attack the former Roman province. In any case, whether invited or not, the Anglo-Saxons waged war on the existing inhabitants of Britain. The Romano-Celtic Brittonic kingdoms, which had been populated by an amalgamation of Celtic and Roman culture, had filled the void after Rome pulled out. This was a well-established culture which had formed and prospered over many centuries. If King Arthur did exist, then it is likely that he was a Brittonic warlord who fought against the Anglo-Saxons in the wake of the power vacuum left by Rome's withdrawal during the 5th and 6th centuries. In any case, the Brittonic kingdoms were devastated and replaced by Anglo-Saxons, leaving only Wales, Cornwall and the Scottish Lowlands under Brittonic rule. Scotland and Ireland, of course, never being conquered by the Romans, were still under true Celtic rule, who in Scotland seemed to be calling themselves Picts by this point, and were famous for covering their bodies in intricate woad and tattoos. The inhabitants of Ireland during this period seem to have called themselves Gaels, although this distinction between them and the Picts is quite fluidic at this point. At some point along the line, the Picts began calling themselves the Scots, and the Gaels began calling themselves Irish. But again, the lines blur together quite a bit here, given that both sides of the Irish Sea are largely culturally homogenous for most of their history. And then there's the sheer lack of written sources to work with. Both Scotland and Ireland had been Christian for many years now and stood at odds with the pagan Anglo-Saxon newcomers. After wiping out, enslaving, or driving away the Romano-Britons, the Anglo-Saxons soon settled in the fertile lands of Britain and began to form a number of disparate kingdoms, such as Wessex, Mercia, Northumbria, East Anglia, and Kent. All waged war amongst themselves for the next several centuries, gradually swallowing up smaller kingdoms until only a handful remained. The main problem in all of this, however, is the sources. They are incredibly hard to come by. Much of our knowledge from this period comes from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which was written much later, and from ecclesiastical histories from the likes of Bede, who inevitably portrayed the past through their own lens, and again were written much later. By the 7th century, evidence of Roman influence over England had largely disappeared. Large ruins did remain, such as at Lundinium and at York, but the newcomers tended to settle in their own towns of wood next to the old Roman towns of stone, which remained as a stark reminder of how far engineering at least had fallen. There was Mercia, largely populated by Angles and Saxons, which historically had been the most powerful state. Offa, of Offa's Dyke fame, had been a Mercian. They tended to have their capital in the East Midlands. Northumbria was the northern kingdom and had its power base at the ancient Roman city of York. East Anglia occupied the same position, roughly, as the modern-day county. And finally, Wessex, the most famous of the bunch, was based in the south. The Anglo-Saxons began converting to Christianity sometime during the 7th century, largely through the efforts of Irish monks, who had already been Christian for hundreds of years now, and had developed a distinct style of Celtic Christianity unique to their island. Gradually, despite still being separated by political borders, a distinctly English literary tradition and culture began to develop, the basis of what would later become the culture of the modern-day nation-state of England. The Anglo-Saxons who had invaded England didn't exist in a vacuum. The lands to the north of Saxony had long developed a militaristic culture which was also maritime in nature. This makes sense, as until very recently it was always easier to get around the fjords and valley systems of Scandinavia via boat rather than road. The emphasis on the sea as a provider rather than the harsh soils of the north can even be seen in gravesites dating back hundreds of years before the Viking Age. This obsession with the sea, combined with a natural scarcity of resources and an increasingly large population, led small bands of Northmen to begin to look outwards to foreign lands to provide a future for themselves. By the late 8th century, first as traders and later as warriors, longboats, packed full of opportunistic Northmen, began raiding the coastlines of Britain. They came looking for land and wealth, and having already established footholds for themselves in the Faroe Islands several decades earlier, before long they began settling in Ireland, on the Scottish Isles, and finally upon the shores of the not yet united land which would come to be known as England. Although the rich literary tradition of Rome had died when the Anglo-Saxons had first invaded in the 5th century, slowly and surely a new, distinctly English one had developed to take its place, one inevitably framed by the new Christian faith of its adherents. In 793, at Lindisfarne Monastery in Northumbria, some of these adherents, the monks who lived and worked there, were shocked and terrified to witness dark sails upon the horizon one morning. Little did they know that longboats would only display a snarling head upon their vessel when they were going Viking or raiding. When they went to trade, no such displays would be shown. On that morning, as the telltale, snarling dragon heads came into view, the monks at Lindisfarne were about to witness firsthand the beginning of a new age, a Viking age. The raid was just one of many during this era, which were only going to increase in their scope and severity all over the British Isles and much further afield as the centuries went on, and as more and more tales of overseas riches and fortunes to be had trickled back to Scandinavia. More and more opportunistic and desperate young men looked outwards from their barren homeland to make a name for themselves. It wasn't long before full-scale invasions were launched from across the Northern Sea. The Northumbrians and East Anglians had now been Christian for hundreds of years and had grown content and complacent in their fertile English lands. They were now faced by their former selves. These newcomers were pagans. They worshipped the pantheon of Norse gods led by Odin. The Anglo-Saxons, just a couple of centuries before, had worshipped Woden, the same god. The Great Heathen Army, as it was dubbed by the Christian writers of the period, swept through the disunited Anglo-Saxon kingdoms in the 860s, snuffing out their existences one by one and replacing them with puppet rulers or outright just putting themselves on the throne. By the 870s, the Northmen had established a large foothold in the northeast of England, which would come to be known as the Danelaw. The legacy of the Danelaw can still be seen today in the place names and surnames, still reminiscent of their Danish origins. By 871, King Alfred of Wessex, a sickly, God-fearing man, was the only Anglo-Saxon king left between the Scandinavians and total dominance of England. Alfred had other ideas, however, and after a number of setbacks, he rallied the fjords together for one final stand against their cousins to the north. At Edington in 878, the men of Wessex were finally victorious, and defeating the Northmen went some way towards shattering their reputation as unbeatable fighters and in turning the tide against the invaders. Over the next decades, Alfred and his descendants worked hard to lay the foundations of a united Angleland. Partly motivated by a desire to defend themselves against the new invaders from the sea, and partly, I'm sure, out of a desire for power and prestige over the other disparate kingdoms of Britain. Meanwhile, by 937, the Northmen, many of them Norwegian in origin rather than the largely Danish men who had invaded England, had become a huge force in the rest of Britain and Ireland, having established themselves significant footholds in Ireland and Scotland. Ireland, having first been settled by Norwegians during the 8th and 9th centuries, was made up of a number of warring native Irish kingdoms, but by now also had a strong Scandinavian influence, many of whom had lived there for over 100 years now in places like Dublin, which had been founded by Norwegians, as did the Scottish Isles and the Isle of Man, which remained strongholds for centuries to come, well into the medieval period. Dublin, not content to sit on its wealth any longer, looked across the Irish Sea to expand its influence into northern England. Scotland had also changed a fair bit since the time of the Picts, several centuries earlier. At some stage, largely because of the melting pot of Gaelic, Pictish, Christian, Brittonic and Germanic influences, began to develop its own Scottish identity under the new King Constantine. Upon completing the unification of England in 927, Alfred's grandson and successor, Athelstan, looked to the north to expand further. Just a handful of years after unification, it would be the turn of the English to become the foreign invader, role which they would take on many more times over the next millennia. By 934, Athelstan, having consolidated his rule after completing the unification process which his grandfather Alfred had started all those years ago, seems to have moved his forces into Scotland, which was ruled by Constantine II at the time. The motivations for this are unclear, whether Athelstan had his sights set on the rest of Britain, or whether the attack was preempting an invasion by the Scottish, who some sources say had broken a truce. Although there are several literary sources from this period, mostly in the forms of poems and songs, they aren't all that reliable, so it is difficult to know exactly what was going on. It does seem clear to me though that even at this early stage, the British just really loved to invade Scotland. By 937, hostilities had come to a head, and Constantine was joined in alliance with King Owen of the Brittonic Kingdom of Strathclyde. A relic of the past, left over from those post-Roman years of Romano-Britain dominance over Britain. The British kings were also joined by Olaf of Dublin, a powerful Irish-Norse king who was possibly looking to become the dominant force in the British Isles. The alliance was likely one of convenience, aimed at curtailing the growing power of Athelstan. Whatever the motivations for the battle, its exact whereabouts have never been conclusively located. Just like the location of Arthur's final battle, it may always remain, like much of this period in history, unknown. Personally, I think the fact that we know so little about it in itself is accurately representative of this time period. We may surmise that the armies had as many as 5,000 or more on either side. Not nearly as many as the Romans once fielded against their major opponents, but large enough to match one another. They would have been roughly equivalent in technology, with the elite household guard, or housecarls, equipped with swords, large shields, helmets, and armour. The vast majority of the Saxon army would have been made up of the fjord, which had been made up of peasantry. They would likely have been armed with anything they could get their hands on. During this period, there was no standard armour or uniform. If you were rich enough, you could afford good equipment, then you stood a better chance of survival. The Northern Alliance would likely have been armed in a similar manner to the Saxons. The armies would have arrayed themselves in a shield wall formation, which in itself was a curious throwback to a half-remembered Roman battle tactic, and the armies would have faced off against each other using largely the same tactics. They stood in tight formation with their shields locked. Both sides would wait each other out until one pushed forward finally to engage the other. Then it would be shield wall versus shield wall, man versus man. The battle was fierce, and many died on both sides. According to the poem, The Battle of Brunanburh in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the Saxons eventually managed to split the shield wall and hewed battle shields with the remnants of hammers. There lay many a warrior by spears destroyed. The northern men shot over shield, likewise Scottish as well, weary, war-sated. It was Athelstan and England who would emerge victorious from the battle, but losses were heavy on both sides. So much so that the situation appears to largely have been a stalemate afterwards. The Battle of Brunanburh recounted that there were never yet as many killed before this with sword's edge, since from the east, Angles and Saxons came up over the broad sea. In the aftermath of the battle, Olaf fled and sailed back to Dublin with the remnants of his army. Constantine escaped north into Scotland. King Owen's fate is not mentioned, although Strathclyde declined until it faded altogether in 1093. Athelstan, although victorious, had lost much of his army and his power steadily declined. After his death, King Olaf of Dublin managed to claim the Kingdom of Northumbria without resistance, effectively ending the first unification of England. But England was once again united by 946, and by 954, upon the death of Eric Bloodaxe, the Norse eventually lost all of their remaining territory in York and Northumbria. For the English, Athelstan's victory had prevented the dissolution of England's unity. For the Scottish and the Irish, it marked the beginning of a legacy of invasion from England, which would continue for the next millennia. Although England had by no means seen the last of the Vikings, who would continue to attack for centuries to come, and even be outright conquered again by them under rulers like Canute and Harthac Canute, the English had, however, at Brunanburh, asserted themselves as a united people who would dominate the British Isles for the centuries to come.